That blessing goes a long way. I count on that. Thank you. It's really good to be here at Word and Life. I want to add one really important credential to Anna's wonderful introduction. Thank you, Anna. Probably the most important identifying characteristic of me right now is that I am the new grandmother of Diego Tomas Howard. Diego Tomas is 8 weeks old, and he lives with his mom, Veronica, and his daddy, Ben Howard, in San Francisco. So I get to see him on Sunday. So I'm happy to be here with you all. It's amazing to see how this group has grown. I think it's been a couple years since I've been back at Word and Life, and I love this group. I brag about you all. I brag about you. I always did to my own parish at Trinity and to others around the country. I say, you can't believe this group of people and how long they have been together, starting out first studying the Bible when that really wasn't a kosher thing to do necessarily in their particular setting, and then branching out and covering all kinds of different topics and authors that, again, might not necessarily be the more traditional authors and topics. And so I just salute you all, and I'm so glad you're still doing this and doing it with such vigor. I'm also really pleased to be able to speak about Desmond Tutu, because he has been my probably number one hero in terms of the church and ethics since before seminary days, but certainly in seminary days for me in the 80s, which is when he won the Nobel. And before that, fighting apartheid, he was a hero to me. He was the witness in the face of apartheid. Then he became that force for justice as the chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. His work has been a beacon for me throughout my own work in the church. And particularly, I think what has fueled that great activism is his deep contemplative prayer practice. He is somebody that Richard Rohr might call a contemplative in action, which, you know, Richard Rohr says is the greatest dance form, to be able to be a contemplative and yet be out there on the edge working for justice. So he's also a person of incredible joy. I mean, just think of Desmond Tutu in that face, and it makes you want to smile. The only other leader I can think of like that would be the Dalai Lama, which is pretty interesting, isn't it? People who have had great suffering in their lives come from a deeper place of joy, maybe, than the rest of us. His Ubuntu theology has been a guide for my own theology and ethics and spiritual practice. Ubuntu, you know, a person is a person through another person. We are persons only because of the way that we interact as persons. So I'm just honored and pleased to be able to be here today. So I want to tell you that I have thought about this book, read it this summer, and then I realized what day this is. It's 9/11. Then, as you know, I'm a preacher, and I probably read all things and approach all things as a preacher. And I'm also aware of the text that is assigned in most of our churches for this Sunday. So I'm going to read you a couple of lines from the text assigned this week from Matthew 18. And so my reflection will be on those words from Matthew, words about, well, you'll see. And as preachers do, or as preachers are supposed to do, I'm going to reflect on those lines from Matthew in light of what today is, 9/11. And in light of Tutu's book. So I'm going to try and combine all three of those things. I hope it works. From the Gospel of Matthew. Then Peter came and said to him, "Lord, if another member of the church sins against me, how often should I forgive? As many as 7 times? Jesus said to him, "Not 7 times, I tell you, but 77 times. 7 times, asked Peter. Peter knows the code of the day. He knows the eye for an eye, the tooth for a tooth, the social contract of his Hebrew culture that called for an equal distribution of justice. He knows that Jesus is instructing the new community in how to be a new kind of community, a new kind of church. And Peter, as ever, wants to prove that he gets it. He's showing off, actually, I think. This is not the first and last time that Peter will do this. He will make big claims, you know, the undying vow that he would have fidelity until that cock crowed in the morning three times. He would have that fidelity. Eager Beaver Peter says he's ready to forgive a wrong not just once, but seven times over. And is Jesus impressed? Is seven times enough? No. Jesus gives a new number, 77 times. A symbolic number it is, really. It's a number beyond imagining. You need to forgive a gazillion times, Jesus says. Again and again and again and again. So is this another one of those camel through the needle's eye moral standards? Another turn the cheek, go the extra mile, 70 times 7, another recipe for guilt for all of us? What about those times when it's so hard to cough up even a half-hearted, I forgive you? Jesus' way might mean that we have to change. There's a call to change in Jesus' call for forgiveness. But it's not so much a command, do this, as it is a promise. In calling for a climate of forgiveness, Jesus offers a whole new social contract. A community based on living in the freedom of God's forgiveness. He called it the kingdom of heaven. He went around saying, repent, change your ways, the kingdom of heaven is here. It's that kind of change that's at the heart of Desmond Tutu's book. The profound heart change that happens on that fourfold path that leads not only to forgiveness, but to healing and wholeness, and not only for ourselves, but for the world around us. Just as Tutu's fourfold path forges a new way, and just as that Truth and Reconciliation Commission stood in contrast to the usual pattern of retributive justice, Jesus' call for change in his new social contract, the new kingdom, stood in sharp contrast to the way of the Roman Empire. It stood in sharp contrast to the temple religion that joined in mute collaboration with the Roman Empire to maintain the status quo. Churches sometimes do this. A status quo that was established in Israel some 10 centuries earlier, a status quo that echoed the dynasties of the pharaohs in each empire, from the pharaohs to the Babylonians, to the Greeks, to the Romans, a small group of economic elites controlled the huge peasant underclass. And a whole system of social and political and religious codes kept the structure in place. But then along comes Jesus, making trouble. He says that way is not right. God cares about the way the world is organized, and God's way is different. And that way is what Desmond Tutu and his daughter Umpho are echoing in this book. With this call to forgiveness, Jesus and Tutu offer a way of life that's characterized not by duplicity and intrigue, but by open, honest, plain speech. Jesus describes a way of God, a way of forgiveness, a way of relating based on trust, integrity, mutual respect, and truth. Because we can't get to forgiveness if we can't first name the truth. That's what Desmond Tutu is telling us. That's what Jesus is telling us. So think about truth for a moment. Not maybe to start with telling the truth. Think about it in the opposite way. What's it like to be lied to? We know what that feels like when all of a sudden, or sometimes with that slow, steady realization, we see we've been betrayed. We know the muscle of a lie. How a lie keeps the liar in a position of knowing, a kind of power over the other. We know what it feels like when someone withholds the whole truth, when someone changes a story to control the situation. We know the confusion we feel, the betrayal. There is nothing like being on the receiving end of a lie to understand the reason that the ninth commandment was important to the Hebrews of the Exodus, to understand the power of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. A lie cripples our ability to trust. A lie rips apart the fabric of community every bit as much as any act of violence. So to build community, we're to forgive 70 times 7. The flip side of that, we could say, is that we're to tell the truth 70 times 7. The two go hand in hand. We can't forgive until we first acknowledge that something is amiss. That's what the fourfold step path is about. We can't forgive until we tell our story, name the wrong. Without that truth-telling, that naming of what's real and not an illusion, we can't begin to forgive. And then, when the reality is exposed, when the truth is told, the false images lay shattered on the floor like so many fragments of a cheap hand mirror. And then the time for building begins. That's the miracle of that fourfold path that Tutu is laying out for us. So, today, on the anniversary of 9/11, we still need to turn to that kind of building, that kind of building of a new world. I think we are as out of practice with the tools needed for that kind of building as we were 13 years ago. We may not be out of practice as individuals, but I believe we are out of practice as a nation and as a world. We're out of practice because truth-telling and forgiveness are at a premium in our world, just as they were in Peter's. Peter needed the practice because he operated so often under a set of illusions about his own good intentions. But when push came to shove, Peter was just as self-protective and just as cowardly, just as equivocating, just as human as I am, or you are. The good news in this story from Matthew is that Jesus' interest in forgiveness isn't limited to private virtue. Not mine, not yours. Jesus' focus was always, always, always on the common good. He gave his teaching and his preaching and his whole life for a way of living for all, a way of life centered on a God of forgiveness and freedom, a radical new way that was not the way of commerce, not the way of the monarchy, not the way of the military, not really even the way of religion. This way of Jesus, where truth speaks to power, where forgiveness flourishes, where communities thrive, where caring for the least among us is a hallmark, well, the world hadn't seen anything like that yet. It didn't match anything at hand in first century Palestine. And it still doesn't. Desmond Tutu's worked toward it in South Africa, but it still doesn't exist. So here we are on the anniversary of 9/11 in the 21st century. And what is truth? Pilate might ask again today. Where is truth? 13 years after our national shock, the crashing of those passenger jets into the Twin Towers and the Pentagon and a Pennsylvania farm field, and we find ourselves still in a context where appearances don't quite match up to reality. 13 years ago, as a nation, we did not dwell long on the horror of that day and on all that we had lost. The loss of our illusion of safety, the loss of any innocence we might have had left. We didn't examine our role in the human family. We did not examine the impact of our support of Israel on the Arab world. We did not examine the roots of terrorism. And all of us, private citizens, our press corps, our elected officials in both parties, we all failed to examine why this had happened, why we ignored the signs of impending attack, We didn't question our leaders. To do so was unpatriotic. We did not demand truth. Truth-telling was at a premium. We didn't grieve our losses long, but we salved our grief with hero stories, preferring to focus on the brave men and women who went into the rubble again and again to recover anyone they could. And they were heroes, to be sure. True heroes. But our focus on them distracted us from the full truth of this overwhelming tragedy. Hero stories make us feel good about ourselves again. We needed something then to take our mind off of the evil that had invaded our lives, and so we jumped from shock and grief and ran that flag right back up to full mast within a month. And we began to start to chart a sure and steady course toward war. A war that we were told was about weapons of mass destruction, or about some link between Osama bin Laden and Iraq, a war to nip terrorism in its bud, a war where the first casualty was truth. In these 13 years, we have lived through times that sometimes look like an Aldous Huxley or George Orwell novel, where we say one thing and mean another. We've all participated in this, and we still do. We're in the grip of global terrorism now far more than we were in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. We have waged an unending war in the Middle East that has sowed the seeds of a new generation of terrorists, and we're seeing this now in the rise of ISIS. We're seeing it in the new continuing explosions in the Gaza, or the bomb that will go off next week or the week after in Syria or Africa. And we know that the airstrikes are beginning. Maybe we will degrade ISIS. Maybe we will nip them in the bud. But what's next? Desmond Tutu, with Jesus at his back, is calling for us to create a different kind of world that's going to sound like, you know, not realistic enough. But that's our call. If we, as people of faith, stake ourselves on anything, it's that we are people who are loved and therefore forgiven, and therefore we love and we forgive. And that fourfold path to forgiveness begins with naming the truth. One of the other truths of our new century was revealed to us in another formative event that we have just observed, an event that changed many of us, an event that I've experienced having changed the next generation. This month, we have remembered again, not only 9/11, but also Hurricane Katrina, the event that gave us some big clues about some new weather patterns and climate change. Weather patterns that have only increased, as we know well, in the midst of this thousand-year drought, and a new brand of tornadoes, and flooding, and snowstorms, and wildfires. And yet, we as a nation managed to turn from truth-telling about our warming planet. Katrina opened our eyes back in 2005 about the weather, and caused a whole new generation to join the effort to address climate change. It opened our eyes about something else in our country, too. I can't tell you how many young people I know, people I work with in the Beatitude Society, tell me that they got interested in the true story behind the headlines, any headlines, because of what they saw in Katrina. Think back for a moment to what flashed across your TV screens during the days after those floods in New Orleans. Think back also to that time when we were speaking for the kind of in new language about homeland security. In the wake of Hurricane Katrina, we saw that homeland security had left us shamefully insecure and ill-prepared. Our National Guard wasn't able to be at the ready. They'd become the overextended farm team for the war in Iraq. We saw terrible images of destruction and death. We saw truth splashed across our TV screens as never before because, as local author Nora Gallagher wrote at the time, we got the story because it happened so fast and right in front of our faces and no one could put a spin on it quickly enough. We got the story because television reporters were openly outraged on camera. We saw something exposed in Katrina, a truth that we knew about but didn't really talk about. We saw the true story, the gleaming underbelly of our old and evil institution, racism. Enter twin sister poverty. We saw that we left the poor and the elderly and sick behind in the event of that hurricane. We saw that we've been leaving them behind for decades and generations. And still today, we live in this richest nation of ours with a permanent underclass. We allow one half of the children of Louisiana and Mississippi still to live below the poverty line. We allow one quarter of the children in our country to live below the poverty line. We established that line in 2014 at $23,000 for a family of four. We give these children poorly equipped schools, woefully equipped schools. We allow their neighborhoods to be the hunting grounds of the most desperate of these children, the uneducated, unemployed young men who traded in hope for a handgun. And then, with each delicious tax cut that has been served up to us by Congress, another social service, from schools to food banks to public health clinics, has shrunk in its paltry efforts to save our ravaged city streets. So, at the same time, we have armored our local police in the name of Homeland Security, and we have rendered them incapable of keeping the peace. No wonder we have rage in the streets. We have seen the lie of Homeland Security again in the streets of Ferguson, Missouri. Now, this look back to Katrina and 9/11 on this anniversary day might seem far removed from Tutu's call for forgiveness and very different images from that lovely rose on the cover of that book. But I told you that I approach this book and this anniversary day as a preacher. And a preacher's job, first and foremost, is to tell the truth. And then the good news. We only get to Easter Sunday by going through Good Friday. And the wave to healing forgiveness begins with hard, tough truth-telling. The stories in this book that are told are not pretty stories. It's our vocation, it's our calling as Christians, as people of faith, to tell the truth. In the face of evil and violence, the challenge to us is to tell the truth, whether that evil and violence happens between two people, behind a closed door, or between nations. We need to practice a kind of speech that's not the common parlance of our day. We must learn to tell the truth and to ask for it. We must ask hard questions of those in whom we place our public trust, because we believe in Jesus' promise of another way to live, another way to organize the world. It's not just another way to organize our personal interior lives or our family relationships. It's another way to organize the whole world. That's the beginning of forgiveness. We start with our own stories, our own need to forgive and be forgiven, Tutu's first step on the fourfold path. But we don't stop with our private and personal story. Faith doesn't stop there. Because we're all connected. We're all part of that larger whole. We are all in this together. On behalf of our own souls and our sisters and our brothers, we're called to name reality for what it is. To question what seems to be not right, from the personal to the public. From the smallest equivocation in a staff meeting to the damaging withholding of truth in a family, to the corrosive pattern of lying that keeps an African-American underclass at the bottom of our economic pyramid. We're to tell the truth and to practice it 70 times 7, a gazillion times, again and again and again. It's not easy. It wasn't easy for Peter. It wasn't easy for Desmond Tutu. It's sure not easy for me. Because it begins with change. But I trust, and here's the Easter piece of the story, I trust that it ends in healing. It ends in healing for my heart and for the heart of the whole human family. That's the promise and the challenge that I think this book offers us. That's why we need a fourfold path to walk step by step by slow step. And that's why the subtitle of this book is The Fourfold Path for Healing Ourselves in Our World. Thank you.